WILP is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and we come to you every Friday morning bringing you the hot issues of the day. Today, we have a special guest who is on a tour on her way from California to Washington, Kelly Hayes Raitt. For nearly three decades, Kelly has earned a reputation as a fearless advocate while working on dozens of California legislative initiatives to protect the environment, secure consumer legal rights, promote educational opportunities, and protect workers and fight for affordable and accessible health care. As a passionate and effective advocate, she has appeared on more than 500 radio and television public affairs shows, including PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CBS This Morning, CNN Financial News, and CNN's Moneyline.
But none of them are as much fun as being on WILP Radio.
Of course. we're in great company here. Appointed to the Santa Monica Commission on the Status of Women, Kelly joined a woman's delegation to Iraq just 5 weeks before the U.S.-led invasion. The Iraqis touched her so deeply that she returned a few months later and provided on-air commentaries from Baghdad, Basra, and Fallujah to KFWB News Radio, KNBC Local Evening News, and National Public Radio. During the next 2 years, Kelly addressed over 200 audiences about her experiences in Iraq, including a group of congresswomen in the U.S. Capitol. To honor her humanitarian leadership, the Los Angeles County Commission on the Status of Women named Kelly the 2004 Woman of the Year. So we are very, very honored to have her here. But before we let her talk, I also want to mention, or maybe you could tell us, she's writing a book that I think we'll all want to read, but particularly, you know, women. The war is so much of a woman's and children's issue. They're the main victims. And so as a women's group, the Women's International League, and Kelly, her interviewing Iraqi women, which she's going to talk about in just a minute, this is particularly close to our hearts. So I'm going to let you tell us about the book, Kelly, and tell us about the work you've been doing with Iraqi women.
Lori, thank you very much. It's a real joy to be here today, especially with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I belong to the Los Angeles chapter, and it's very near and dear to my heart. So I'm going to encourage all your listeners to join WILF because it's very important, and I think your website is WILF.org, WILPF.org. This is my first time to the South, actually. I live in California. I'm from Buffalo, New York, originally. And I've been spending the fall in Columbus, Georgia, where I've been working on enjoying a fellowship, writing my book, Violating Sanctions, An American Woman's Listening Tour Through the Axis of Evil. And that actually was a beautiful segue that you made about how war really does impact women, because that's what my book is about, and specifically about how it impacted, how war and traveling throughout the Middle East and working with refugees has impacted me personally. So it's a combination of interviews with people who have been personally affected by our U.S. foreign policies and how working with those women has affected me as an American woman. Mm-hmm. I did go to Iraq in February of 2003, which was just 5 weeks before the U.S.-led invasion and occupation. I'd never been to the Middle East. I'd never been any place as threatened as Iraq was at that time, so it was really life-changing. I was there the day that Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the United Nations and said, the weapons inspections aren't working, right? We remember that terrible day. Mm-hmm. And the next day, President Bush came out and said, the game is over. Mm-hmm. Well, Iraqi women heard that. And they literally came up to me on the street and grabbed my arm and implored me, begged me to go home and ask President Bush not to bomb them.
Oh.
They knew war. These were women who had lived through it. many of the women and the children that I talked to in February of 2003 told me about the impacts of the first Gulf War. It was in 1991. We dropped 90,000 tons of explosives over the entire country of Iraq in a 42-day period. As we were talking about earlier, we hit water treatment plants, sewage treatment plants, homes, bridges, schools, hospitals. I mean, we devastated the infrastructure in 91. And over the next decade, the Iraqis were not able to rebuild that infrastructure because of the U.S.-led and sanctions. They couldn't import spare parts to rebuild or chlorine because chlorine was on the do not import list because it could be used to build chemical weapons. So consequently, Iraqis weren't able to purify their drinking water. So every day, they couldn't rebuild their sewage treatment plants. So every day, Iraqis were dumping 500,000 metric tons of raw sewage into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers every day. Now, these were drinking water sources. So consequently, people were drinking tainted drinking water. Again, they couldn't rebuild the water treatment plants or import chlorine. Childhood diarrhea spiked in Iraq during the 1990s. The average Iraqi child had diarrhea 14 days a month during the 1990s as a result of the bombing in 91 and the sanctions. Literally every other family experienced the death of a child under the age of five before this last war.
And how many, you know, how many Americans realize sanctions sounds like such a clean word, you know, it is war by other means.
It is. It's economic warfare. And Saddam Hussein wasn't affected by the sanctions and his cronies weren't. You know, it was something that really does bubble down to people. And I think a lot of Americans, I certainly didn't realize how vulnerable the Iraqis were when we did start bombing in March of 2003. I mentioned that we dropped 90,000 tons of explosives during the 91 war. In March of 2003, on just that first day of bombing just Baghdad, we dropped 10 times that amount.
Our shock and awe.
We dropped 900,000 tons of explosives on just Baghdad in just one day.
My God.
So we have devastated the infrastructure, and people were very devastated there. Now, when I went back to Iraq in July of 2003, I was really, like all of us, very heartsick watching what was unfolding in front of us on our TV sets at home. And I really wanted to go back and find many of those people that had touched me. And what I found there, quite honestly, was a wide variety of opinions that ranged from Bush bad, Saddam good, go home, to thank you, America, we couldn't have done it without you. And I really did run the gamut. People had a wide variety of emotions and responses to what was happening just a few months later. And there was a lot of hope in Iraq at that time. That's not there anymore. This was a country of 26 million people before the war, half of whom were under the age of 15. Okay, so 13 million adults. The civilian casualty rate of Iraqis now ranges from about 100,000 from the very most conservative numbers of Iraqi civilians who've actually been killed by some sort of violent means as a result of the war, to a million Iraqis, civilian casualties. If you look at epidemiological numbers, that would include things like people not being able to get their medicines or people dying of other kinds of stress-related diseases prematurely. So however you look at it, whether it's a million people or 100,000 innocent civilians who have died as a result of this war so far, 4 million Iraqis are homeless. 2 million are displaced internally in Iraq. 2 million have fled to Syria and Jordan and Lebanon. Now, I don't want to throw a bunch of numbers out at people as they're having their first cup of coffee on a Friday morning. That's pretty rude. I'm sorry about that. But the numbers are huge, and nobody's talking about what's happening with Iraqi refugees. I just spent the summer in Syria working with an organization. I'm going to do a couple plugs. I hope it's okay.
That is fine.
I was with a group called the Middle East Fellowship, and their website is MiddleEastFellowship.org. They're a nonprofit organization based out of Pasadena, California. They did an extraordinary summer encounter in Damascus this last year. It was a new program. We had an incredible opportunity to learn Arabic and learn about the culture and what's happening in society there now. But most importantly, we spend every morning volunteering with Iraqi refugees through the Greek Orthodox Church in Damascus, which is doing a number of different programs to help refugees, vocational training and food bank programs, things like that. So we were really hands-on with refugees. Now, in Syria, there are, conservatively, 1.2 million Iraqi refugees. This is a country of 20 million people. Syria right now is experiencing 30% inflation, 20% unemployment. Literally the month before I arrived last summer, energy rates had quadrupled overnight because the government had gotten rid of government subsidies for electricity and for energy. There was such an outcry about it that the government then turned around and offered Syrian families credits that they could use, but did not give those credits to Iraqi refugees.
So they're resenting the refugees?
They are, and it's very difficult. I mean,
it's not that rich a country to take in that.
So just to sort of take the numbers, because the numbers are big.
Yeah. You
know, 20 million people, 1.2 million refugees, what does all this mean? It would be the equivalent of us adding the population of Texas to the United States and having that be just a refugee population. That's the impact that that's had on the economy in Syria. Now, I want to just put this in perspective, too, because the refugees who left were people who left with money. So these aren't necessarily poor people walking around in the street. These are highly educated engineers, teachers, architects, people who have, you know, high degrees who've left and who had the money and the means to be able to leave Iraq. That's who's in Syria right now. They're not allowed to work because the Syrian government doesn't want the competition from the refugees for the few jobs that are available for Syrians. They are allowed to go to school. Syria has been very generous about opening up its schools to all of these kids who are a difficult group to teach because many of these children are traumatized. Nobody's talking about trauma because everybody's experiencing it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you about my husband getting killed when I know your child was kidnapped and killed. I mean, people just don't talk about it. Many of the children skipped grades, just missed school because it was not secure enough for them to be able to go to school. So many of them are older, being held back in school. And there are differences between the Iraqi and the Syrian curricula. So it's been a very difficult and interesting challenge for Syria to school these children. And yet they have. They've been very generous in doing it.
Well, that brings up a question to me. Since we did the war, are we not going to send any money or not sending any aid to Syria because of them taking in refugees from our war? And the other question I have is, are we taking in any refugees?
Both good questions. We do not send, as far as I know, we don't send any direct aid to Syria because Syria is on our U.S. State Department sanction list. So, I actually traveled to Syria. It was a legal trip, one of the few I've made, but it was a legal trip at the invitation of the Greek Orthodox Church. But there's no diplomatic relations between the United States and Syria. We don't have an embassy there. We have an embassy, but we don't have it staffed with an ambassador.
Oh, I see.
Now, the other question you asked was very important, and that's what's the United States doing to take in these refugees?
Exactly.
For the first 4 years of the war, we took in 5,000 Iraqi refugees out of 4 million displaced people. Now, the numbers are going up, which is a good trend. Last year, we'd brought in 12,000 refugees. This year, our target number is 17,000. We are probably on target to do that. So we're moving in the right direction. But when you look at that, that's about 30,000 people that have been, you know, out of 4 million refugees. I feel that that's quite criminal, but that's what our government is doing.
Yeah, okay. Well, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's the question that came to me.
Now, we are doing some indirect aid to specific organizations in Syria that are helping refugees, and some of that money is coming through our State Department, which was something that I found out in Syria. It was kind of a surprise to me. So there are ways that the United States is helping both formally and informally, and there are a number of ways that Americans can help on an informal basis, and I hope we can save time at the end of the show for that, because I think it's important.
Definitely. So So you were there, and you were interviewing refugee women in Syria. How long were you there for?
I was in Syria for 2.5 months, and many of my interviews are up on my blog. Can I do a little plug on that?
Sure, please tell
us. Okay, it's peacepathfoundation.org. Peace, path, like the path you walk, P-A-T-H, foundation.org.
Okay.
The way to reach me is on that, and on that website, as well as interviews with different women and children that I've had, not only in Syria, but also a couple of my Iraq articles, and also interviews I've had with Palestinian women as well.
Yeah, I see that you, on the paper that you gave me here, that you were interviewing Palestinians in Lebanon and the West Bank. Was that the same time that you, did you go from Syria there? Did you go back another time? Tell us about it.
That was a previous trip. I was in the West Bank in the spring of 2007, and I was in Lebanon in the fall of 2007, both with delegations, primarily with organizations that wanted to help people out. One of the things, you know, watching what's happening in Gaza right now just gives me chills. I happen to be in Lebanon the year after the war between the war, the skirmish, however you want to call these things. The words are almost meaningless at this point. But the war between Hezbollah and Israel that happened in 2006. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like it's deja vu all over again. I mean, this is crazy. And I'm just,
let me just interrupt you for a minute. It's time for us to take a station break, because this is a big topic about Palestine and the whole Mideast, but with we're all particularly horrified at what's happening in Gaza right now. So I want to just do our station break and then get back to that. This is Wilp's Wake Up Call, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We're on WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And our underwriter is Internationalist Books on 405 West Franklin Street. The Internationalist Books has books that you're not going to get in Borders or the chain bookstores, books by progressive writers and a wide variety, but it's also a community resource. You can find out many things that are happening in the community by stopping in and browsing and looking at the books and find out what's going on. We particularly want to mention that Orange County is going to have a big celebration. It's a combination of a Martin Luther King tribute and an Orange County inaugural celebration. And that's going to be on Sunday, January 18th, this Sunday at 5 p.m. at the Century Center in Carrboro. They're going to have 6 bands, 2 stages, Martin Luther King tributes, music, poetry, children's activities, a dance party, and more. Oh my gosh, this sounds wonderful. The Century Center activities and celebration will start, it will be from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then you can go over to the Southern Rail in Carrboro, and they're going to have live music and a dance party from 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. All evening, local restaurants are giving discounts for inaugural celebration participants. The Century Center festivities are free. The inaugural all-access pass is $10 or a donation of canned goods for the Yes We Can project. That pass is required for access to restaurant discounts and entry to the dance party at Southern Rail. And it's this whole wonderful party is organized by the Orange County Campaign for Change. All Orange County citizens are invited to come usher in a new era in our nation's history with this community gathering and celebration. Wow, my goodness. And I think that we'll get back now to our guest and go from, this is kind of a disjointed thing, to go from talking about a new era and celebration to what's happening in the Mideast, and we're particularly focusing right now on the tragic, horrifying situation in Gaza and Kelly's experience with talking to Palestinian women and refugees. Kelly, let's get back to you.
Well, it is kind of a hard segue to go from celebration to what's happening over there. But just like in our country, where we've just experienced an opportunity, a new opportunity with our election, I think Israel also has that right now as well. Their elections are going to be next month. And personally, I believe that a lot of this grandstanding that Israel is doing that's having such a devastating impact on families and women and children in the Gaza Strip is politically motivated. Mm-hmm. You know, just like we saw our own incursion in Iraq was so politically motivated. But I don't want to dwell a lot on it because I know that there's a lot of conversation happening around Gaza right now and a lot of frustration. But I am absolutely appalled that Israel would bomb UN facilities in Gaza. It's bad enough when we see the UN getting bombed in places like Baghdad. But the United Nations created Israel. The irony of that is something that people aren't talking about. I mean, the humanitarian aspect of it is huge and should be the focus of our conversation. But how... I'm on radio and I'm losing words. That's not a good thing.
But that's a point I hadn't thought about, that the UN created Israel, and then Israel. How many UN buildings have they bombed? Hospital, school, now this
warehouse
mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. all the supplies that are needed.
Well, and more importantly, where people were seeking shelter. Where civilians were seeking shelter.
Yeah.
You know, it's the idea of a country being able to go into a civilian area and unilaterally start bombing without any regard to the civilian population that is around the quote-unquote military target is unconscionable. And Israel is not being held up to international standards, humanitarian standards. I did see myself in the West Bank, what the settler movement is doing there. And I want to be very clear. My experience there is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, the settlers are very conservative, religious zealots. And they do not represent the people that I know who are Jewish mm-hmm. or Jewish faith, a Jewish heritage, a Jewish religion, and did not represent people that I met in Israel, mm-hmm. the majority of the people. It's very minority people, but who are getting support from the Israeli government, mm-hmm. which, by and large, the Israelis I met were not supportive of their own government in many ways that many of the Americans I know have not been supportive of our government mm-hmm. in the last 8 years mm-hmm. or our government's policies. So these are people who, the Israeli settlers, are people who are really creating, and I think the word apartheid is accurate, an apartheid situation mm-hmm. in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
I personally helped escort Palestinian school children to school in the morning, mm-hmm. along with Israeli soldiers, who had to escort these children through a pass where settler women, Israeli settler women, would come out and stone these children on a regular basis.
Oh, my
God. And the reason why the settler women were doing it is because they're so conservative religiously that the male Israeli soldiers were not allowed to touch the women. So we were in this situation where it was the Israeli soldiers who were accompanying the Palestinian children to provide them safety against the Israeli settler women. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just you can't keep score. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the kind of unfairness that happens. And this is a tiny, tiny, tiny little thing, particularly when we look at what's happening in Gaza right now. But this is the daily indignity and the daily insecurity that Palestinian children are growing up with.
Yeah.
And this has been going on now for 50 years. And it's getting worse over the last 10 years.
And I guess you also experience the checkpoints, which are all over the West Bank. And I don't think many Americans realize that. You think of a checkpoint as something you go and you show your paper or whatever and get through. They don't realize that there are so many of them that to go like 10 miles away, you may go through four or five checkpoints. You might want to tell us a little bit about your
experience. Right, and you're exactly right. And a checkpoint could take you 5 minutes to go through one day and 5 hours the next day, and the next day you're not allowed through at all. I mean, that's part of the way of maintaining control over people, is that level of frustration. Can I read just a tiny bit from my book for about 1 minute?
Please do. And mention the name of your book again.
Okay. And the book is not out yet. So watch my blog, peacepathfoundation.org.
Okay.
And the book is Violating Sanctions, An American Woman's Listening Tour Through the Axis of Evil.
Okay. So this is from your listening tour.
Right. This is one page. I want to lighten it up a little bit because it is morning. This piece is called Flashed in Fallujah. Back when it was just another angry Iraqi city, and months before it became the major flashpoint in U.S.-Iraqi relations, I toured Fallujah. I was investigating war damage at a water treatment plant several weeks after President Bush's declaration of mission accomplished, when a man exposed himself to me. He'd been brushing close against me as I walked along the narrow sidewalks that separated the water treatment ponds, the folds of his shoulder-to-ankle robe commingling uncomfortably with my long skirt in the 115-degree heat. I pulled my purse in front of me, defensively elbowing space between us. Later, while I was interviewing the water district manager about her staff's heroic efforts to keep the water flowing during the first onslaught of war, this strange man squatted unobtrusively in a doorway, caught my eye, lifted his dish dasha, and displayed how Allah had been very generous to him. I was shocked and awed. Talk about weapons of mass distraction. What's a white girl in a war zone to do? Being flashed in Fallujah isn't covered in the Human Rights Handbook. I knew from his quietly creepy behavior that he was violating standards. But should I speak up and risk offending my hosts? The town was already pretty edgy. Later that afternoon, I would be warned that Fallujans had vowed to kill an American a day in retaliation for the U.S. troops' gunfire exchange with locals who had taken refuge in a school. Schools are revered in Iraq, and our blanketing one with bullets had further ignited this rebellious community. But I was always taught that bullies bank on us staying politely silent. That man exposed himself to me, I pointed at him as stiffly as he had to me. My male translator looked at me confused. This gentle man, whose religious practice kept him from even touching a member of the opposite gender, repeated something in Arabic to the water treatment workers gathered around us. Meanwhile, in the confusion, the exhibitionist had lowered his dish dasha and skulked out. Well, I had no idea it would cause such a stir. Workers ran after the man, mortified that his aberrant behavior might reflect on them. They made such a fuss with their apologies, I began to feel guilty. It was no big deal, I offered, rolling my eyes. Really, it was no big deal, I lied. I guess one of the men understood my double entendre because he burst out laughing, easing the tension. We lose so much in war, and humor is right there with truth among the first casualties. Standing in battle-scarred Fallujah, a stranger and I started the rebuilding by bonding over a very worn pun, proving that when we're brave enough to laugh at ourselves, what really gets exposed is our humanity.
Thank you. That was a nice respite from the sad and tragic things that we're talking about. We're getting close to the end of our program. I want to just mention our website that people might be interested in. It's triangle wilpf.org, and WILPF is WILPF. So triangle wilpf.org, please check it out. We're doing lots of interesting things and would love to let you know about them. Maybe Kelly, you could tell us some things that people could do after hearing what you've been doing and hearing about all that's going on. Maybe you could tell us some things our listeners could do to help out.
Sure. There are four quick things that I think are possibilities for people. The organization that I really am quite enamored with these days is called the Iraqi Student Project, and their website is iraqistudentproject.org. So two Americans who are living in Damascus, they have been organizing colleges in the United States to provide four-year scholarships to students, Iraqi students, who would not have an opportunity to go to school or work otherwise. They have 14 students who are in America this fall for the first time enjoying scholarships. Uh-huh. Duke or UNC should be right up there with them. And you can get more information on that on my website at peacepathfoundation.org. MiddleEastFellowship.org. The Middle East Fellowship, MiddleEastFellowship.org, is still providing opportunities for people to travel to the Middle East to see firsthand what kind of an impact the United States policies have had. There's a single man who is putting together opportunities for students in Iraq to do computer video conferencing with schools, high schools here in the United States. There's more information about him on my website as well,
okay.
peacepathfoundation.org.
Okay. How are we doing on time? Okay, we're going to be wrapping up. Kelly, it's been wonderful having you here, and it's just amazing the work that you have been doing. And, you know, we can read about these things in the paper or magazines, but to have a firsthand account is very moving. We are brought to you by WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, your local low-power radio station, that we are so happy to be part of. And again, we are the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Goodbye.